All right, 2-minute meditation starts now. Prayer. This one's called Solutions. Don't be afraid to explore. Without exploration, there are no discoveries. Don't be afraid of partial solutions. Without the tentative, there is no accomplishment. Indecision and procrastination are corrosive habits. Those who wait for every little thing to be perfect before they embark on a project, or who dislike the compromise of a partial solution, are among the least happy. Ideal circumstances are seldom given to anyone for an undertaking. Instead, there is uncertainty in every situation. The wise are those who can wrest great advantage from circumstances opaque to everyone else. Wanting everything in life to be perfect before you take action is like wanting to reach a destination without travel. For those who follow spirit, travel is every bit as important as the destination, one step after another. That is still central to the wisdom of spirit. Every day passes whether you participate or not. If you are not careful, years will go by and you will only have regrets. If you cannot solve a problem all at once, at least make a stab at it. Reduce your problems into smaller, more manageable packages, and you can make measurable progress towards achievement. If you wait for everything to be perfect according to your preconceived plans, then you may well wait forever. If you go out and work with the current of life, you may find that success comes from building upon small things.
All right, page 63 in our big book. It says next. What is next?
When I just Immediately.
Okay. Next, we launched. So some can say the third step is the launching pad. We've launched out on a course of vigorous action. The type of action we're going to take, it requires energy and a lot of it. The first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. Though our decision in the third step was vital and crucial, it will have little permanent effect unless at once. When is at once? Right now. Unless at once followed by a strenuous effort, steps 4 through 9 specifically, to face and to be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us from what? From God, higher power, from ourselves, from other people. Our drugs and alcohol are but symptoms, so we have to get down to causes and conditions.
So who in here has attempted a fourth step? Okay. A fair number, maybe half. And that next is important. I was in a meeting one time, and the meeting was about the fourth step, and the guy said in the meeting, "So I've done my third step prayer. When do I start the fourth step?" And then, you know, crosstalk is where you share directly at somebody. Then the meeting became a crosstalk meeting about what this gentleman was supposed to do and when he was supposed to start the fourth step. And a lot of it sounded like, well, you should talk to your sponsor, you should listen to your sponsor when you're ready, so on and so forth. I had already shared, but I felt like he was giving a bunch of bad information, so I double dipped and I said, well, the book that I've got says next, as in third step prayer, go. Right? Just want to make sure that that's crystal clear, that that's what next means. Go!
So, we're not going to spend a lot of time discussing mechanics. I think you guys have great teachers here that can show you how to write inventory. What we want to do is share our experience with certain ideas and concepts and thoughts that we have about the actual process of writing inventory and why it's so important. So in the fourth step, they talk about unblocking us. I have a theory based on writing inventory. God willing and the creek don't rise, on November 5th of this year, I'll have 13 years of continuous sobriety on the 12-step path. And when I got back here the last time, when I was brought back and I was incarcerated, I knew. I'd been going to meetings off and on for over 3 years, so I knew the higher power thing was a thing. But I was in such a place of surrender, and my willingness was, you know, had reached a level where I just needed someone to tell me what to do, and I was going to do it. And that's what I found. With an understanding that I was not here to find a personal relationship with God, I had no issues with God. I had no antipathy towards God. I had no disgust when the word God came up. I didn't cringe or any of that stuff. But I just, at the same time, there was something more attractive to me in the big book. And the first time they reference it is in the doctor's opinion. And it says, until a psychic change occurs, little, it says he's doomed. I won't use the F word this time. It says that Tarek is doomed unless the psychic change occurs. And then when we were in the chapter, there is a solution in a big book study I was in. We were told to flip back to page 567, which is in the fourth edition. That's the spiritual experience appendix. And we read through that. And there, you know, at the end of the day, it's about change, and it's also telling us that not everyone's going to have a white light experience. It's going to be an awakening, so to speak, in the literal sense, a slow awakening for a lot of us. But what jumped out to me was a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism and drug addiction. And I don't know about any of you, but for myself, I had never attempted a house cleaning before I got to the 12 steps. My entire life had been lived this way. I know who I'm angry at. I know who's let me down. I know who gets on my nerves. I know who's assassinated my character. I know who's broken commitments. And if you said, describe why you're angry at these individuals, I could take their inventory all day long. I've been doing it my whole life. And then if you said, Tarek, how did that affect you? And that's really what we're talking about in the third column. Although the seven areas of self in the third column are self-esteem, what I think or feel about myself in this situation with this person. My pride is how I want others to view me in this situation with this person. My ambition, which is what I want out of this situation. What outcome do I want to have happen here or have had happen, so if it's in the past, which they're always in the past. What did I want to have happen? Security is more of an internal thing. What do I need? I need validation. I need respect. I need to feel secure. Whatever I need to be okay in that situation. Personal relationships, the way I look at them is if I'm writing a piece of inventory about my mother, I have deep-seated ideas and thoughts about how a mother should behave. So they'll come out. If it's about my girlfriend, it's a deep-seated belief about how a girlfriend should operate in this situation. If it's about a colleague at work, I have a deep-seated belief about that person or that dynamic, that relationship. So that's how I write it. Sex relations always has to do with the gender I'm writing about. If it's a man, I have a deep-seated belief about how a man should be, how he should be showing up right now. If it's a woman, I'm writing about a woman, then I have thoughts and values about how a woman should show up. And these are that's how you write an extended third column. And then pocketbook's easy. Were my time or money affected? It's a yes-no question. I have done that my entire life. And then the big book on the next page, on page 66, it says, we turn back to the list for it holds the key to the future. Every time I take someone through the big book and we get there, I ask the question, why do you think this list holds the key to your future? And I'll give you a hint. It has to do with my troubles are all of my own making. All of them arise out of myself. I'm an extreme example of self-will and right. That was the paragraph we read before we took our lunch break. So who wants to take a crack at answering this question? Why does this list in our fourth step hold the key to the future? Yes.
6 and 7.
Yes. Yes. These are correct answers. Not the one I'm looking for, though.
The truth about yourself.
Excuse me?
The truth about yourself.
Yes. Not the one I'm looking for. These are all true.
So, daily inventory.
Excuse me?
Set you up for daily inventory.
That one's 50-50. I don't know about that one.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah? Okay. Yes.
We're finally putting it on paper.
Say that again?
We're finally putting it on paper.
Yes.
Does that mean so they're number one receptor?
Yes. Okay. All right. So, remember what I said.
All correct. All correct.
My whole life, I know who I'm angry at, I know what they did, and I can tell you how it affected me. But never once in my entire life had I set aside entirely what that person or institution did to me and take a look of how I put myself in that situation. What mistakes did I make? Where was I at fault? How did I get the ball rolling? How did I get myself here? That never. I was the assigner of blame. I perfected that role. I could always describe how it was always someone else's fault more than mine, right? Did not want to take my responsibility for my life. So what I call that is I lived in effect. That means shit was always happening to me, right? This process is to get you to live in this phrase called at cause. So you take 100% responsibility for your life. And that removes you from the victim role. Right, and so, look, guys, we're going to get into a couple of issues like you know, I had sexual trauma. I was, you know, violated by someone when I was like 5, 6, 7 years old. And I have used this process. Now, did that 5 or 6, 7 year old do anything to create that? How is that trouble of the making of the 5, 6, or 7 year old? But what did I do from probably the age of like 14 and 15 all the way to age 31?
Let me answer. So did the 5, 6, and 7 year old do anything wrong? The answer is absolutely no fucking way. Just so it's clear. That 5, 6, 7 year old did nothing wrong. At all. Period. End of sentence. That's it. What he's getting ready to say is very important.
So what was posed to me was the consideration that the troubles I was having in my life at that time, and probably in the first several years, I mean, I'm probably into my sobriety too, because I've done a lot of therapy and like inner child work, and I've done all that stuff and brought it into the spiritual path we call the 12 steps. But what happened was, I considered the idea that since the event had taken place, you know, 25, 26, 27, 28 years ago, that it was no longer based in reality. It no longer existed, right? The 5, 6, 7 year old that happened to no longer exists. It was a very sad and traumatic event that took place. But what I did was I used it as an excuse to justify my behavior, right? Of why life had dealt me a bad hand. So when I went back and revisited the experience and I was able to interpret it in a new way, I was able to describe what happened, give it a new interpretation, which then gave it a new meaning, which then allowed me to frame it in a new way in my psychological process. Because I don't care, you know, yes, we're working the 12 steps, but inventory is a psychological process. It is. I mean, that's what we're looking at here. There's no, you can't get escape it. It is what's going on. There are a ton of people that have now monetized a lot of this stuff that they use in therapy. I mean, I've seen it. I've read books. I was like, man, this is just like the inventory we rewrite. But now it's got a specific name to it. But I digress. And so what I woke up to was I gave it a new meaning. And the most valuable thing is that it became something that was okay. It became integrated into who I am. And the way I discovered that integration, and I'm not using the word heal because I don't think I'm ever going to fully heal from that. It still ripples into my life in probably ways I'm not even aware of most of the time. But what I can say is that I consider it to be a jewel, and I say this only because I've sponsored men, and I've gotten to help men who have not been the guys I sponsor, but guys that I quote-unquote mentor. They look to me for some type of guidance that have had that happen to them. And so I've been in my own way able to help them begin to interpret that experience in a new way, which hopefully over the course of time will change the meaning of it. And so it's really important that we talk about these things, because when you're talking about the fourth column and this list holds the key to the future, there's going to be times when it's really difficult. And that's one, being a man, right? Okay, so I gave you that one. I was participating in a convention up in Canada, and I went to see a woman that I respect. She was a speaker, and so I wanted to go listen to her talk. And she gave one of the most powerful talks I've ever witnessed in my life. But this was a woman who had been, she had been raped repeatedly by her uncle for years. I'm talking from like the age of like 9 until like she was in her teens. And the trauma, of course, had led to coping mechanisms, drugs, alcohol. She became a crackhead. She had 2 kids. She lost her kids. She ends up doing a bunch of like really mean things to the man, her uncle, and you know they had their relationship was full of hate. Of course, that would, you know, probably make sense to all of us. And she was sitting up there on the podium, and she was giving her description, and she was talking about making amends, and he was someone she had to make amends for. And so you can imagine what the crowd, like half that room was like, what do you mean you made amends to a guy who molested and raped you as a child? And she said, well, she said, we have this human condition that's a broken condition. And for me, I went through life experiences that created that condition, but some of that stuff was already there before of the experiences. So she was alluding to the fact that some of this we're born with. You know, I think we're handed certain attributes about ourselves through genetics. And she was trying to explain, you know, when I started using drugs, I had this broken internal condition and I couldn't stand it. So I had to put things, I had to put things in my body in order to that for that thing to be still and be quiet. And as a result, I would activate the phenomenon of craving, and then I couldn't tell you what was going to happen. You know, the way I describe it, she knew all bets were off. She didn't know how much she was going to do, how long it was going to last, where it was going to take her. And she understood compulsion, like powerlessness. She understood it from her experience with drugs and alcohol, right? And she said, what hit me was, we're blessed because we have the broken internal condition and we seek substances to treat it. And then we have our experience with the escalation of that relationship with the substances. She said there are other people that have a broken internal condition, and then they have their own mental obsessions or things that will treat their condition. And just like us, when they start to do something, they are under the spell of a compulsion. And then she said it woke up that he was under the spell of a compulsion when he was doing those things to her. I'm talking, this took me to another level when it comes to understanding this stuff on a big picture, right? And, you know, it's a heinous crime. It's, you know, it's reprehensible. It's, you know, a lot. But the reality is it happens in our world, unfortunately. But listening to her from a female's perspective about how she got free and she was able to go and make amends because, like, I think she had, like, robbed him at one point, broken into his house. Like, either she beat him up or she had people beat him up. I mean, she'd done a lot of stuff. And she went and made amends. But it was in this inventory process of why the list holds the key to the future. What happened? When she got to the fourth column, she set aside entirely what the other person had done, and she looked for her own mistakes and where she had been at fault. She was able to disregard the events of the past and look at the things that she did afterwards. Right? To me, it's one of the most powerful testimonies I've heard in the entire time I've been here. But that's what it talks about on page 66 to 67. We call this the sick man prayer. And so I would imagine there's no way she has the capacity or I have the capacity to even entertain the idea of forgiveness if we don't have compassion first. And to me, page 66 to 67 I call this the bridge of compassion. Right? So this is our course. We realize that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, "This is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done." And so I'm praying and asking my higher power to show me the same patience and tolerance and pity that I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. This is, and I think, like, when I take guys through the steps, they, when they're writing inventory and they're complete, they finish their third column, they say a prayer, this prayer, before they start writing the fourth column. Because if you don't have access to that compassion, it's going to be very difficult for you to see how you were at fault. And it's also one of the most watered down pieces in Alcoholics Anonymous. Let's read what it says on page 67. These are the exact comments that the book has about the list. Referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely as if they weren't there. Where was I to blame? The inventory is mine, not the other man or woman's. When I see my faults, I list them. I place them before me in black and white. I admit my wrongs honestly, and I'm willing to set these matters straight. Nowhere in that paragraph does it say my part, does it? How many people in this room have sat in a meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous talking about the fourth step and talking about, oh, that the most important thing is for me to see my part? Yeah.
Okay, let's assume that this entire notepad is the entire situation. Every single page in it is everything surrounding the resentment. Okay? Now, if we look at it from Brandon's perspective, if all of these pages is the entire situation, you know how much Brandon's going to claim? This is my part right here. Right? Do you see it? This is the entire situation. All these pages. This is all I got. Right? So if I have a part, what does that mean? They got a big part according to this notepad, right? They got a whole hell of a lot. So that means when I'm ready to go make amends for this little thing that I did to them, your turn. Go ahead and tell me what you did now. And I'm waiting for them to talk about all their part, right? But if I'm looking for my mistakes, and I'm there to make amends for my mistakes, a little bit different, isn't it? So you guys want to see how this works? You guys were here last night, right? At least in
real quick, well, I want to, before you go. Okay. What he just described is even more important when it comes to going to make amends to someone that messed you over way more than you messed them over. I had a bunch of amends that the people that I was sitting down with to make the amends, the things they had done to me were extraordinarily greater than what I had done to them. If I had gone in looking for my part, when I went to that amends, and I'm telling you, very few of them made amends for what they had done to me. If I was looking at it from parts and their part was bigger, thank God I had a good sponsor that taught me it didn't matter. I was there to clean up my mistakes and where I was at fault. It doesn't matter if they make amends to you or not. I would have got up and walked out with a new resentment. Right? And
motherfucker.
It never happened to me. Not once did I walk away from an amends. I mean, I walked away with my feelings hurt, you know? I walked away not really happy with the things I had done or been like in a lot of situations. I was made aware of things I had forgotten about, right? Or what I showed up to make the amends for was not even what they were pissed at. Yeah. Anyway, so we're jumping ahead, but it's really important that you get this. You know, it's funny because I sponsor guys and I have the exact same conversation, and then I go sit in a meeting and listen to him share, and he says my part, and I'm like, what the hell? I mean, was he not present for like our conversation? And I'm telling the story because it's like we're robots. We're like parrots. We just repeat shit, and we don't understand. It's like when they tell you to turn it over. Is there like a magic button underneath this desk that someone's
like an easy button?
Yeah. Boop, boop. When you turn 10 years old, we're going to tell you where the magic button is, so you can just turn it over. You know, when you guys hear these crazy things that people say in meetings sometimes. What I invite you to do is walk up to a person and ask them, what do you mean?
And if they say the exact same thing back to you, it means they don't fucking know what they mean.
No.
Turn it over. So what do you mean by turn it over? You know, turn it over.
How do you do that? Ask the question.
You know, do the next right thing. How do you do the next right thing? You just do the next right thing. Okay, look, I'm a motherfucker that does the wrong thing all the time. So how do I do the next right thing? You just do the next right thing. Okay. So you don't know either then.
Good.
All right. So most of you were here at least in body last night. Well, I don't know if you were paying attention or not, but so I've written a pretty fair amount of inventory in my time here, and I I can do it pretty quick now. I usually don't even have to write it down. I'm so good at it. I know how to ask myself the questions and go through it. And it's real clear when I get to what's really going on in the situation. And then I usually call somebody and share it with them and talk through it, right? Well, intentionally, knowing that we were coming here this weekend, I didn't write any inventory on the man that I told you about last night. I didn't. Because I didn't want to see it yet. So when Tarek started talking, I started writing. Okay? Time myself, it was about 5.5 minutes it took me to write a single piece of inventory. I don't know if any of you were watching me or paying attention to me, but something shifted when I was writing. Okay? This is the piece of inventory. This is a standard resentment as written by Brandon. Okay? Column one, the dad. Right? What's the resentment? Column two, he's an asshole and won't cooperate. Right? You guys know what, you're down with that, right? Most people would agree, if they knew the story, that column two is absolutely 100% correct. This guy's an asshole, and he won't cooperate, he's difficult, he's a pain in the ass. Amen. Yes. Self-esteem, who am I? I'm the most loving, helpful ex-husband and dad. Anybody that knows me would agree completely with that statement, right? Pride. What do others need to know about me? Others should know not to fuck with me. True. Don't do it. Ambition. What do I want? I want him to leave us alone. Security. What do I need to be okay? I need him to cooperate to be okay. Okay? Personal relationships. A real ex-husband pays his bills on time and is cooperative. Sex relations. A real man is respectful to women. Pocketbook. He wastes my time and money. All of that that I just wrote, most people knowing the situation would completely co-sign what I'm saying and agree with it. Except for, you know, not everybody might think I'm the most loving and helpful ex-husband and dad. But I think that most people watching me would say it's probably true. Okay? So what about my mistakes? Column four. What am I really afraid of here? Well, I'm afraid that this will drag out and it will cost me tons of money. Oh. Now you're threatening my internally you're threatening my money, which is a big deal, right? So wait, I thought this guy was an asshole. No, I'm afraid I'm going to lose money here, right? Okay, where am I being dishonest? My fear drives the dishonesty within me. I really just want him to bow down to me and admit that I'm better at everything than him. I'm a better dad, stepdad, ex-husband, everything, right? There's no entitlement there, is there? Not expecting something from somebody else that I'm not willing to give him, am I? Where am I being selfish? Well, I strategize and manipulate him in an effect to control him, okay? What was the second part of the resentment? He won't cooperate? Well, if I'm controlling him and he's resisting, guess what? He's not cooperating. Weird, huh? So I have a desire at control, and he has a desire to not be controlled, so I'm meeting resistance. Isn't that weird? Why? I don't understand how that's happening. Okay? So where am I being self-centered? What you're seeing is compassion showing up for somebody else. Okay? Man just went through a second divorce. Okay? We don't know because he's not honest about it, but I don't think he has a job right now. This is a man that has made somewhere between a quarter of a million and $750,000 a year, and I don't think he's working. What's a man feel like when he doesn't have a job? When he can't provide? Yeah. Right? He's also wrapped up in the middle of an addiction, right? That's controlling his life. He spends nearly half of his waking hours in his garage smoking pot to deal with his anxiety. What kind of life is that? Right? So where am I being self-centered? I don't know what's driving him. I don't know what's going on in his life. I don't know if he has an income. I'm confident he's lonely. And I know for certain that he thinks that he's right. One piece of inventory. You see the energy change towards this man? You think inventory has power? Now, because of the situation we're in, I can't walk up to him and make an amends to him right now. But based on this, I owe him one. And remember, if he showed up on my front porch, I would have ripped his throat out. Kind of weird, isn't it?
You know, jumping ahead a little bit, you know, if I'm listening to this fifth step, he just shared that inventory. One of the questions I repeatedly ask when I'm listening to someone's inventory is, do you see how this troubles of your own making? Do you see how this troubles of your own making? You know, and clearly, his identification of his desire to control, his need to be right, and the other things that he listed, he's able to see how this situation's of his own making and how these troubles arise out of himself. Because there is someone else on this planet who has those same set of circumstances who is handling the situation differently. So these are like, this is the conversation. I need some wiggle room when I'm listening to an inventory. Just to get them to see where they've made mistakes and where they're at fault and how that has contributed to them placing themselves in this situation. And it's difficult because I know all of the circumstances around this. And even when I'm listening to Brandon sometimes on the phone, I'm like, damn, this dude's a fucking piece of shit. You know, that's what I want to blurt out on the phone, but I can't do that. That's going to hurt Brandon and if I co-sign it, right? And sometimes I probably don't say a lot because it's hard for me because I see a very difficult situation. But that's the worst thing a sponsor can ever do to a sponsee is to, like, take their side, really. A sponsor is always going to be on the other person's side to a degree. Otherwise, we're not doing our jobs.
And you see how we went through that. I looked at my mistakes, and I never actually, in that, it doesn't make the rest of it, it doesn't condone what he's doing. It doesn't say that it's okay for him to treat us the way that he's treating us. It doesn't say that. But it also gets me into a position where I can see how there's probably some things that I could do to ease it a little bit, right? To maybe not be so controlling. Maybe not try to manipulate so much, right? So, can't get him to be different, but I can be different. And I can guarantee you that the next email I get from him, I'm going to remember that where am I being self-seeking? And I'm going to remember that he's a person that's struggling right now. Right? I'm going to have a little more compassion for what he's going through. Now, convincing my lovely wife that we should have compassion for it, one of the most compassionate people I know, probably not a good conversation to have. Just telling you, right? She's got her own resentment. She's got her own shit. Let her have it, right? This is my resentment, not hers. She doesn't have to do the spiritual work that we do for her to be sane. She's just naturally loving and caring towards other people. Weird. I don't get it. But that's how she lives, right? So real life shit right there in front of you, okay? The whole process. Now, essentially, we fifth stepped it, so if you guys would like to interject and offer your comments during the break, I might listen to you. So, resentment? Good. So, then at the bottom of page 67, it says, notice that the word fear, it's talking back about the kind of the columns that they show, is bracketed alongside the difficulties with a bunch of these people. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. Good God, if you guys could walk around in the world right now, what you would experience is this thing called fear touching every aspect of everybody's lives almost globally. Somehow we have manufactured fear for export in levels that's never happened before, right now. The world has gone insane. Okay? Well, you saw just how I was acting when this guy's threatening my money, right? What happens when somebody's threatening your life? How are you going to act? Right? And so, that's what's going on in the world around us right now, is this constant fear. Do you have anything you want to hit on that?
On fear?
Yeah. I mean, I have a bunch more, but go ahead.
You know, in that part of the book, they talk about matching calamity with serenity. And, you know, mechanically, you know, the fears inventory can be done, you know, right out of the book. What's the fear? Why do I have this fear? How did I set the ball rolling? Is there perhaps a better way? Answering those four questions. But the big book, you know, it sort of gives you the answer to all the questions. It says where self-reliance fails. So then we have to, at least me, I'd like to, well, what's the purpose of fear? Because there's instinctual fear and there's psychological fear, and they're two different things. The instinctual fear is what kicks in when I'm, you know, crossing a busy intersection, right? Or like when I see a snake. I don't like snakes. And I saw one earlier here. Not cool. And then there's psychological fear. And typically there are two questions you can ask yourself if you're aware enough, if you have the self-observation and the self-awareness to say, am I in any physical danger right this moment? And the answer 99.9% of the time is no. Followed up by a second question, which is there anything I can do to change what it is I'm afraid of? And the answer is typically no. Then I immediately know my fear is not based in anything that's in the present moment. So those are practices that you can implement. But in terms of fear serving a purpose, I think there's a reason they put that part in the book, though. And I just connected this the past few weeks. Calamity with serenity. It's like the whole adage of, like, you know, faith and courage. Faith and fear have to exist at the same time. They have to exist at the same time. That's how fear is overcome. And that's why in our big book it says, you know, we ask God to remove our fears, direct our attention to what He would have us be, and we commence to outgrow fear. In that moment, we outgrow the fear. But then, depending on the circumstances in your life and what's going on, 5 minutes later, you can be consumed by the fear again. And so then we go back into this, okay, let me ask God to remove my fear and direct my attention what He would have me be. Let me take a deep breath and let me acknowledge the presence of God with me as I breathe. Imagination has to be involved, I get it. And then I go back and turn back to what I was doing. And I go through this process repeatedly. But guess what the fear has done at this point? The fear has forced me to communicate with my higher power. So how do you build reliance upon a higher power if you don't communicate with the higher power? And what causes us to turn to our higher power? Fear. is one of the things that causes us to turn to our higher power. So what I'm trying to get you guys to sort of start to look at from a different angle is like fear. We don't want to be consumed by fear. We don't want the fabric of our existence to be shot through with it. But at the same time, we can see how it serves a purpose. And fear can expose things about ourselves that we're struggling with. So therefore, we learn more about ourselves, right? And there's a wonderful tradition that one of the teachings in the tradition is he who knows himself knows his Lord. And so as things are being exposed about myself, I am learning about myself and this unique version of God. I'm a manifestation. There's a little piece of what Brandon described earlier, that big thing that you chop up, and there's always a little piece. So I have a degree of contingency. I am held in existence by this power called God. And at some point, this existence called God is going to say, I no longer want to animate this little creature right here. And I die. That's what's going to happen at some point. I don't know when it's going to be. But that's the way I look at things. And so the fears serve a purpose for me. They expose things about me. They force me into the deeper communication with my higher power. They increase the sincerity of my prayers. So not all negative. You know, like I think a lot of people think that it's not like I want to live life. Like right in, it's such a incredible time and such a sad time to be alive. Right. Incredible, because that stuff going on out in the world right now is unprecedented. It is wild, man. It's like a boiling kettle out there. And that's the way it's supposed to be right now. And do I experience fear around it? Hell yeah. I'm a guy that's never shot a gun. Right? I've never shot a gun. And I'm watching a desire to purchase guns. Right? Because I have no idea how crazy it's going to get. I mean, hell, I mean, we're under martial law to a degree. It's really fucked up, right? That I can't make my own decisions. This is my belief systems, outside issues. I don't want to bring them in here. What I want to talk about is the fear that it's creating in me. So it's exposing things. You know, the only reason I have a desire to buy a gun is because there's a fear, right? I'll convince myself, no, I want to protect my family. But it's both. It's because I'm afraid and I want to protect my family. And that's what we're dealing with here. And in our society, there's fear everywhere. I see it every time I go to the grocery store, every time I go to the bank, every time I go to Target. And it's so sad because I'm afforded an opportunity because of the spiritual practices and trying to attempt to cultivate the expectancy of God in my life. I get brief respites from that fear, and then they come back. And so it's vital because I don't know any other way. I couldn't imagine trying to navigate through life right now without this idea that the fear is perhaps moving me deeper into God. I need God. I have to have God. Like these spiritual practices, I've got to amplify them right now. Right? I need to spend more time being still. When I do my personal retreats, so I can actually navigate outside, because it's unlike anything any of us have ever experienced, and that creates fear. But I think what's really important is that we remember that our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure, and I think it's important. I'm reading something from Marianne Williamson that I love. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You're a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We are all meant to shine as children do. We were born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It's not just in some of us, it's in every one. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. So we have to have some beacons of light out here, because all I see everywhere I go is it's dark, and it is really fear-based everywhere you go. It's like a halo of darkness over everyone that I encounter for the most part, except for people that are on a spiritual path, like the 12 steps. They don't seem to struggle to the same degree. right? But I've watched some of my closest friends also become fear-based. And it's really, it's disheartening to a degree.
So they've actually scientifically proven that fear actually serves you not at all. It actually creates stimulus within you that actually harms your health. It lowers your immune system. It does all sorts of things. I'm not talking about fight or flight, the initial, or that instinctual thing where, like, something happens and you need to react to it. That's like lizard brain programmed in shit. Can't take it out. But the actual fear that keeps your body in a constant state of tension harms you physically, mentally, spiritually, every way possible. Okay? So when you encounter fear, this is more of a philosophical discussion around fear. When you encounter fear, you're faced with a decision of, is there anything I can do, like Tarek said? Okay, so, and to understand what's really going on. So in the current situation, what has happened for Brandon is that I've looked and I've seen some things that are fearful to me. And so what has been clear to me is that we don't really, there's a level of uncertainty in the economy. There's a level of uncertainty in health. And it seems like the people that are maybe overweight, have breathing problems, asthma, sleep apnea, those people are at risk during this, with this virus, right? Well, guess what? Brandon's got all that, right? So what can Brandon do to fix that? Well, he can eat better. He can lose some weight, get in better shape, okay? I'm reporting back that that has started happening and there has been some signs of improvement. I can also tell you that I've, for a number of years, I've made it a goal of mine to eliminate all debt whatsoever. No mortgage, nothing. I don't want any of it. And, like, I'm making some pretty big strides lately, and I've changed the way that I'm paying some things because I want to owe nobody on this planet so that when the shit goes to hell, fine, I'm good. Okay? So fear, in that case, has actually caused me to make some changes in my life that I should have probably already made anyways. But the big man up wherever it is, and I have had some conversations, said, what do I need to worry about? And said, why don't you get in better shape and try to get rid of the rest of your debt? Okay. So that's what I'm doing. So this power, if you have a relationship with it, you can kind of interact with it. And we're in inventory, and I have no idea how we got so far off the tangent, but perhaps,
my fault.
Perhaps there is a better way. We think so. For we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying on God. We trust the infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role that God assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think God would have us, and humbly rely upon God, does God enable us to match calamity with serenity? No. Guys, walking into completely fearful situations in a calm, because you've inventoried this fear and you understand. And I can tell you there's another way that we do fear sometimes, that you boil it all down to one thing, and the one thing is, one and only thing, the only place that fear comes from at all is an inability to have faith and trust in God. And I can tell you now, being almost 9 years on the spiritual path, the hardest part about trusting God is trusting God. And believing that God actually has a plan. Two Tuesdays ago, I was pretty pissed off at whatever that power is and saying, what the fuck is going on? I can tell you that one of my favorite prayers and one of the most useful prayers and one of the most powerful prayers that I have with God is, what the fuck is going on? I always get an answer. It's usually not what I like, but it gives me some direction. This idea that you have to be very focused and proper in prayer, it's wrong. Okay? I have a lot of guys that I've sponsored over the years that are very They're very dogmatic in the way they pray. And I tell them that they have to have at least two cuss words in every prayer that they say. Because they need to break the mold of just, oh God, please, our Father, you know, like, no, that's not a, that, that's a prayer, but it's, there's no energy behind it. Put the energy behind your prayers. God, remove my fear. What the fuck is going on? What should I do? The book says, we ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. I just said the same prayer two different ways. One of them was formal, one of them wasn't. If you're a formal person, maybe your prayer needs to be formal. I'm not. So God and I have this little, like, I'm hanging out with one of my buddies kind of conversation type stuff. I highly recommend it. It's very useful for me. I'm very successful with it.
I went off on that tangent of trying to explain the amped up fear that we currently have in the world and how it drives me into my relationship with God, therefore placing a positive light on fear. But I have no desire to live a life of fear either. And the best way I can explain what I'm trying to say is 3 years ago, my dad was dying. And I'll tell more about this when I get to my ninth step. But, and it might come up in the fifth step next session. But for a long story short, my dad and I had no relationship from the time I was 16 until I got sober at 31 and went to make amends to him. And then we became really good friends, and we quote unquote fell in love with each other again, father and son. And so it was my responsibility to take care of my father when he was dying. And that creates fear when it's the first person. I had not experienced the death of a loved one before this. So I was taking my dad to chemo, and there's a lot of fear when you're sitting around a bunch of people that are staring death down, like literally. Sitting in a chemo, I don't know if anybody else has sat in chemo ward Friday after Friday. It tends to make you think about things you normally don't think about. And so there was fear there. And then my marriage fell apart. And my ex, the woman I was married to asked me to move out. And I went from having the leave it to Beaver, you know, like that house, white picket fence, two nice cars, big mortgage, stepdaughter, swim club, soccer, all the stuff, right, that we thought we would say to ourselves, I have arrived, I have it all. Well, that falls apart, and then I am 10 years clean and I am homeless. And when I say homeless, it means I didn't have a place to call home. I was living out of a bag with my friend, and I was fearful, and I didn't understand what was going on. But the because of this inventory of fear changes. It's not like it was before we had spiritual tools. So now fear shows up and we've got these tools. But I was talking to one of my mentors, and he's like, I was explaining to him, why I was afraid and why I was angry with God. And one of the two things he said to me, he's like, but you're communicating with God. This is a good thing. And the second thing he said, he goes, can you describe the degree of sincerity you're experiencing when you pray? And I said, these are the most sincere prayers I've ever said, because I am on my knees, almost in a begging position, asking God to protect me as part of my prayer, because I knew I needed the protection, because everything was so crazy in my life at that point. But I can't ignore that the fear I was experiencing was creating a need for God. And again, I'm always going to be that guy. Anything that you come to me with, I'm going to say, well, is it creating a need to have a God of your understanding in your life? And when you start to live that way, it actually makes a sentence in the big book come alive. God is everything or else he is nothing. What is your choice to be? And so a lot of people, what do you mean God is everything? We're describing to you what it means for God to be everything. It means somehow we're navigating through life and we're always referring to this relationship. We're like, he's praying, I'm acknowledging, I'm cultivating the expectancy of God's presence in my life. You know, I'm angry at God. You know, I feel like God's not treating me the right way. These are all indicative of relationships we have on a day-to-day basis, are they not? That means that has to happen in the same relationship with God. Those character or those relationship attributes have to be present here. But like for a lot of people, I think the God relationship is somewhat of an abstract thing. And it can't be abstract. Not for junkies and alcoholics. It just can't. It's got to be more than that. Does that make sense? You guys picking up what I'm putting down? Yeah?
Sure.
Yes.
Explain more about the abstract
mindset. Let's see, how do I say this? It's like when we think about dying, but it's hard for us to think about our own physical death. It's an abstract thing. There is a part of us, especially in addicts and alcoholics, that really believes we're going to live forever. Right? Because look at the way we take care of ourselves. Look to, like, I'm just as guilty, right? There is something going on here that says I'm just not going to expire anytime soon. Right? And so that's an abstract thing. And so with God, if it was not abstract, like my relationship with God has a lot of similarities to my relationship with Brandon. I communicate with Brandon almost every day. I communicate with God almost every day. Right? I share my struggles with Brandon. I share my struggles with God. I look for Brandon for clarity and understanding sometimes. I ask God for clarity and understanding of what's going on in my life on a daily basis. Now, I'm not saying Brandon is God, but I'm telling you, it's not abstract to me. It's not like I'm asking, like, I really do think God is right here with me right now. It's not abstract. You know, so what I will invite you to, like, you know, for a while, even in my early days of sobriety, it's like God was with me in the morning for prayer and meditation, and then Tarek went on autopilot, and then he comes back at night, and I check in with God again.
Right. Or said another way is there's me, then there's the priest, minister, rabbi who communicates with God. That's this thing. I go to the priest, minister, rabbi. They interpret whatever God's supposed to tell me, and then they tell me. Well, that's really abstract, right? And Mark Houston says it, you know, a disease so horrific that it demands a direct communication with power. No priests, no ministers, no rabbis. Nothing in between. Direct power. So, another way is that if God is the source of power, you know, I'm a type of guy that I need to go and plug into the power. So I got to take the cord and go plug it in right there and get a direct feed to it. It can't be somewhere else. It's got to be right here. Because if it's not right here, I'm fucked. I need it now. And so it's not some conceptual thing. It's there. And when you start to have it there with you, it's no longer abstract. It's an interaction. It's an interactive God.
Does that answer the question?
Yeah.
Okay, awesome. Any other questions?
Earlier you were talking about deep-seated... all right, so I guess where did deep-seated, like when people are, when they come to us, where did deep-seated come from, or how is it supposed to?
When you say deep-seated, that's in the...
An example. Give us an example.
Like for your resentment, you said like...
If you're writing a piece of inventory and it's about, for example, I'm going to read you a piece of inventory. This is the best way I can explain this. Give me one second.
You know, the other thing that's happened in light of everything that's going on is my prayer and meditation life, as a result of the craziness in the world, is like unstoppable right now. So it's I've really come to rely much more on the practices of prayer and meditation and a discipline of it. It may have been somewhat sporadic previously, but in over the last couple months, I mean, solid, just consistent.
You got it?
Yeah. So this is an old piece. This is a piece of inventory. It's a couple years old. It's my ex-wife. All right, it's actually like 4 years old. She insists on spending a significant amount of money on a new wedding band, but also complains about living at my parents' and wanting to get our own place. So column three, my self-esteem. I'm a responsible provider who exhibits perfect fiscal responsibility at all times.
Of course.
I am a man who does not need material things for validation.
Makes sense to me.
Oh, I can't help but laugh at this horseshit. Pride is no one should make my agnosticism or my fear or difficulty in trusting God when it comes to money apparent.
Yeah, come on.
Ambition. I don't want to spend money on a new ring.
Oh, okay.
Security. I need her to respect my wishes and see my way in order to be okay. Now we get to yours. My deep-seated beliefs about a married individual building a future together. Two married individuals building a future together don't spend money frivolously. All right? The bullshit in that is I can spend money frivolously, she can't. All right?
But you see how he worded it to kind of like get around it a little bit.
That's my belief.
But the marriage doesn't.
The solution would actually be compassion.
We're really just looking for our limited views of the world. When you say a deep-seated belief about how a married individual should act, they shouldn't spend money privately. It's going on in the background. It's got me in confrontation with this person. The screwy part is I don't live by that value, but I want her to live by that value, right? Because I'll go off and spend money any way I want to because I'm in charge of the finances. But then as soon as she does it, I got all this issue with it. Yeah. This is the tragedy of the ego right here. And then my deep-seated belief about a real woman doesn't need bling on her finger to feel like a real woman, right? I'm telling you, these are just beliefs that came out of me, but I'm not saying they're right. This is why I write, this is why we got, I mean, to some degree, this is why we got high and drunk for so long, because there's all this confusion and contradiction and conflict within us. And it puts us in these confrontations with people. Okay, does that answer your question now?
Yeah. Another way to say it is the programming that we've been taught and we accepted. Right. So here's what's crazy. So if you're born and raised in Texas, and you're born and raised in California, you think you might have some different programming going on there. But yet, the people in California think that their programming is 100% correct. And the people in Texas think their programming is 100% correct. Who's correct? So the deep-seated belief is the programming that somebody gave us when we were younger or at some point in time in our life. And we accepted it as true. It's our morality. Is there a different morality amongst thieves and drug addicts than there is amongst regular people? You betcha. When you're stealing, you're not ratting somebody out, right? Well, if you're not a thief and somebody steals your shit, you're ratting somebody out, right? Different morality. It's programming that we've accepted. So the deep-seated belief is that programming that we have absolutely accepted and has become part of the fabric of the way that we live.
Any other questions?
Break?
Yeah.
All right, let's take a break and come back at... just come back at 3:30. Part of me wants to skip sex
inventory. I'll hit this paragraph and talk a little bit about my understanding of how things change and how sex inventory is turning more into